This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Center for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
The Jodcast News. And in this edition, the supernova that wasn't, the search for fast radio bursts continues, and the amateur astronomers moving into radio astronomy. Have you ever wanted to sneeze, but it didn't happen? The whole body readies itself for the coming explosion. You make the ah sound, but then nothing. No sneeze. Just you with a surprised and disappointed look. Something similar has happened on a slightly different scale to N6946-BH1, a star in the Fireworks Galaxy. It's called that because there are lots of supernova associated with it. The life of stars is well understood. At the end of their lives, large stars with masses in excess of 3 solar masses swell in size to supermassive red giants when they switch from hydrogen to helium fusion. When their stocks of helium start to run out, they collapse. The bounce back from that collapse is a supernova, one of the most spectacular events that astronomers can witness. N6946-BH1 seemed to be following the pattern. In 2009, astronomers from Ohio State University saw the star brightness increase. This, they thought, was a precursor to the star going supernova. But then the massive star failed to explode. In fact, it disappeared from view. The team from Ohio State, working alongside astronomers from the University of Oklahoma, searched for the star using the Hubble and Spitzer space telescopes. They failed to find any supernova or remnant. In fact, the star had become invisible in the visual band and was only 5,000 times as bright as the Sun in infrared radiation. Initial theories were that the supernova had been obscured by dust ejected from the star, but this did not stand up to observations. Ohio State professor Christopher Kochanek's new theory is that supermassive stars simply failed to go on to supernova and instead collapsed to a black hole. He and his team suggest that N6946-BH1 formed a dense core surrounded by an envelope of gas, mostly hydrogen. This envelope extended out to a similar size as the orbit of Jupiter. Owing to its size, the envelope was only weakly gravitationally attached to the core. When the core collapsed, the shockwave that passed through the envelope was weak, certainly not up to the strength needed for a supernova. It is possible that there's an optimum size for a star to form a supernova. Too small, like our Sun, and the star forms a white dwarf. Too big, and the star's core collapses to form a black hole without triggering a supernova. As Scott Adams, one of the lead authors on the paper, indicates, 10-30% of massive stars die as failed supernova, so there are fewer observed supernovae than should be occurring if all massive stars die that way. Further observation in the X-ray and possibly gravitational waves using the LIGO observatory could give us more information on the deaths of these supermassive stars. Fast radio bursts have been causing a stir in the radio astronomy community over the last few years. Professor Duncan Lorimer, based at the West Virginia University, before then Manchester University, spent the summer of 2006 reviewing data from the Parkes Radio Observatory. He and his research student found a millisecond pulse recorded in 2001. Initially, it was thought that the pulse had a terrestrial origin, not unlike the signal that the Green Bank Telescope in West Virginia discovered, only for it to be the microwave oven in the observatory cafeteria. Further examination of data uncovered more fast radio bursts, or FRBs. To date, 24 FRBs have been observed, but they did not seem to be confined to the galactic plane, suggesting that these had an extragalactic origin. If that's the case, then the source of these FRBs must be very powerful. The discovery of FRB 12-1102 in 2012 by multiple telescopes strongly suggests the source for that burst being a dwarf galaxy 3 billion light-years from the Earth. This FRB also repeated, first after 50 hours, then sometimes later, saw pulses just over 20 seconds apart. This raises questions over the source of these extremely powerful bursts of energy. With such a small set of data to work with, the causes of these FRBs is open to multiple explanations, ranging from emerging black holes to extraterrestrial civilizations. What is needed is a far greater data set. Some telescopes, such as BINGO, the Barron Acoustic Oscillation from Integrated Neutral Gas Observations Telescope, CHIME, the Canadian Hydrogen Intensity Mapping Experiment, and their Chinese equivalent Tianlai, will spend a lot of time observing the sky at frequencies around 1 GHz. They will cover a large area of the sky, and so should pick up more examples of FRBs. As of now, CHIME and Tianlai are both in their early stages of operation, and BINGO is still on the drawing boards. So what could be used in the meantime? Professor Mike Garrett, director of the Jodrell Bank Center for Astrophysics, suggests expanding the E-Merlin system. The E-Merlin system includes the 2 large dishes at Jodrell Bank, as well as 5 other dishes extending out to Cambridge. Professor Garrett suggests that adding extra dishes, including the large communication satellite dish at Goonhilly in Cornwall, would increase the capacity of E-Merlin to spot, and more importantly, to get precise locations for the sources. If the FRB is associated with galactic centers, then supermassive black holes could provide a mechanism. If they're associated with the edges of galaxies, then some mechanism associated with new stars could be the answer. Till we gather more data, all we can do is speculate on the source of these enigmatic bursts of radio noise. While many amateur astronomers are active in observing invisible light, there are far fewer observing at radio wavelengths. Amateurs, some working as part of Project Jove, have over the years been able to use basic receivers to pick up radio signals from Jupiter, which is a bright radio source in the sky. This is changing with the introduction of software-defined radios. These radios use computers to do all the heavy lifting in tuning and processing the signal. It was discovered that some inexpensive USB TV tuners contain chipsets that would allow them to be used at frequencies far outside the TV bands. The R820T chipset can receive radio frequencies continuously from 30 MHz up to 2 GHz. While these have many terrestrial uses, such as monitoring ADS-B signals from commercial aircraft and picking up weather images from NOAA satellites, it's the area of radio astronomy that offers opportunities to amateur astronomers. Mario Canistra on the Haxter.io website shows how to build an inexpensive updated version of Project Jove's Jupiter receiver using an SDR, an up converter to take the 20 MHz signal from Jupiter up above the 30 MHz lower limit for the SDR, a low noise amplifier and a Raspberry Pi computer. For less than £100 you can record radio signals from Jupiter. More adventurous amateurs are picking up signals from much farther afield. The R820T SDR works well at 1420 MHz, which is where you can find the hydrogen emission line. A satellite dish with a home-built antenna feed built around a tin can is sufficient to pick up hydrogen emission for the Milky Way, along with a red and blue Doppler-shifted line from the spiral arms. Other sources are more of a challenge. An SDR is not very sensitive, so a target with a large signal-to-noise ratio is preferred. Steve Olney, administrator of the Neutron Star Group, has reported the successful detection of pulsars by astronomers using SDRs. This is not for the faint-hearted. Hannes Fasching, based in Austria, has detected pulsars using a 7.3-meter dish, while Mario Natali, based in Italy, uses a 5-meter dish. And if those dishes are a bit too big for your back garden, then Steve Olney has finally been able to make his own confirmed pulsar detection using a 42-element circularly polarized Yagi antenna tuned for 436 MHz and an RTL SDR. A 42-element Yagi is a long antenna, and his setup has the antenna pointing vertically upwards. His target is the Vela pulsar, which happens to pass almost directly overhead at his location. The signal from the pulsar has to be recorded over several hours. It's then subjected to a process called epoch folding, in which short time intervals are superimposed over each other. As the pulsar is extremely regular, if the correct period is chosen, then the repeated signal should emerge. This technique runs the risk of identifying terrestrial sources with a regular period, so Steve has to observe the sky when the pulsar is not in view. The lack of a signal does suggest a successful detection in this case. The fact that relatively inexpensive equipment is able to make valid observations of radio sources suggests that this growing field of amateur astronomy will be making important contributions in the future.